Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, March 21st. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. And here's our first story. One race needs primary. Filing deadline has ended for 2024. This is by Sarah Watson. The only competitive primary for state or federal offices on Scott County ballots this June will be for Congress. The filing deadline passed March 15th for candidates to file for state races, and no other candidate in Scott, Clinton, and Muscatine counties face a primary challenger. The 2024 primary will be June 4th, and the general election is November 5th. Marionette Miller Meeks, Iowa's 1st District Representative, will seek her third term in November. David Posh, the Quad Cities Prayer Breakfast organizer, is challenging her for the Republican nomination. Christina Bohannon is running unopposed for the Democratic nomination for the district. Come November, Scott County residents will see at least one new face in the state legislature representing them. House District 81 in Davenport is held by first-term Representative Luana Stoltenberg, a Republican. She announced earlier this year she would not seek re-election to the seat. School board member and union leader Dan Gosa, a Democrat, was the only partisan candidate to file by the March 15th deadline in District 81. No Republicans filed by the deadline, but the party can still nominate a candidate after the primary at a political convention. Here's who else is running for the Iowa legislature in Scott, Clinton, and Muscatine counties. House District 70. The district covers northern Scott County, western Clinton County, and Maquoketa in Jackson County. We have Republican Norlin Mommensen, a farmer from DeWitt and the incumbent representative. For Democratic side, we have Kay Pence, a union organizer from rural Scott County and current chair of the Scott County Democrats. Based on the candidate filings, November is likely to be a rematch between Norlin Mommensen, a Republican incumbent farmer from DeWitt, and Democratic challenger Kay Pence, a telephone technician, union organizer, and current chair of the Scott County Democrats. Norlin has served on the legislature since 2015, and Pence ran against him in 2022 also. Tomorrow, Wednesday morning, we will be hard at work talking to voters across IL-17 about our vision to return this district to a safe, free, and economically prosperous community, a place where people want to live, work, and raise a family, he said in the announcement. He is a retired judge and former prosecutor who sat on the bench in the 17th Judicial Circuit, which covers Boone and Winnebago counties. Sorensen did not face a challenger in the Democratic primary. District-wide, McGraw received, I feel like we're skipping something here. I want to make sure I'm reading the right thing here. Okay. I am, but I feel like I've missed something. Okay, so district-wide, McGraw received 19,967, or 67% of the vote. And Kroll received 9,567, or 32% of the vote, according to the Associated Press election results. As of Wednesday, AP was reporting that 91% of the vote had been counted for the Illinois 17th Congressional District. The race was called by AP at about 9:15 Tuesday night. The Illinois 17th Congressional District encompasses portions of all of Stevenson, Winnebago, Carroll, Whiteside, Rock Island, Mercer, Warren, Knox, Fulton, McDonough, Tazewell, and McLean counties. In the 37th district, we have Leandro Arellano Jr. Dixon won the 37th Senate district. The district covers all of Whiteside and Lee counties, along with parts of Rock Island, Henry, Bureau, Stark, Peoria, Woodford, Marshall, LaSalle, DeKalb, and Ogle counties. As there is no Democrat running in the district, Arellano is expected to succeed current Republican Senator Wynn Stoller, as he did not run for re-election. I am very grateful I will be able to bring my small business and government reform background to Springfield to begin to help turn Illinois around like I did as mayor in Dixon, Arellano said in a media release. County board seat for District 19 will see a contested race in the November general election. J. Robert Westfall is being challenged by Jeff Stuhler. District 19 encompasses a portion of the city of Rock Island, which includes the downtown, Longview Park, and neighborhoods near the park. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump won the Illinois primary. Biden received 92% of votes in Rock Island County, and Trump received 78%. Statewide, Biden received 91% and Trump received 80%, according to the AP election results.
This is by Caleb McCullough in Des Moines, headline. Iowa law enforcement officials could arrest and order the removal of an immigrant who entered the U.S. illegally under a bill House lawmakers sent to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk on Tuesday. The bill, Senate File Number 2340, would create a new crime of illegal reentry and allow the state to prosecute immigrants if they are found to be in the country illegally after previously being denied entry or deported. Iowa Republicans have proposed several immigration enforcement bills this year, but the bill is the first to gain the approval of both chambers of the legislature. Republicans argue the measures are necessary to respond to record numbers of illegal border crossings under President Joe Biden and have accused Biden of abandoning his responsibility to secure the border. Also on Tuesday, a similar Texas law was briefly allowed to take effect by the U.S. Supreme Court before being blocked for a second time by a federal appeals court while a court challenge plays out. The Texas law would allow state officials to arrest and deport immigrants who entered illegally. Immigration enforcement is generally the responsibility of the federal government, and opponents have argued that states do not have the authority to take measures like those in the Texas law and the Iowa bill. The bill passed the House 64-30 with mostly Republican support. Democratic Representatives Joseph Turek of Council Bluffs and Kenan Judge of Waukee joined Republicans in support, while Republican Representative Brian Lose of Bon Durant joined most Democrats in voting against it. It is now eligible to be signed into law by Reynolds, a Republican. President Biden and his administration have failed to enforce our immigration laws, and in doing so, have compromised the sovereignty of our nation and the safety of its people, Reynolds said in a statement provided by a spokesperson. States have stepped in to secure the border, preventing illegal migrants from entering our country and protecting our citizens. Americans deserve nothing less. I look forward to signing the SF-2340 into law. The bill and others like it have been opposed by a coalition of immigrant activists as they've made their way through the lawmaking process. Manny Galvez, a board member of Eastern Iowa immigrant rights group Escucha Mi Voz, said in a statement on Tuesday the group would attempt to block the bill through courts and other avenues. From Texas to Iowa, our message is, no tengan miedo, have no fear, Galvez said. We will continue to fight this unconstitutional law during the rulemaking, in the courts and on the streets. We will continue to organize to stop deportations, protect refugee children, and keep families together. What does the bill do? Under the bill, a person arrested for illegal reentry by Iowa law enforcement could be punished with a Class D or Class C felony, depending on the circumstances. A Class D felony carries a prison sentence of up to 5 years, and someone convicted of a Class C felony could be sentenced up to 10 years in prison. During court proceedings, a judge could issue an order to a person charged under the law requiring them to return to their country of origin. Law enforcement would not be able to arrest a person for violating the law while they are at school, religious institutions, healthcare facility, or a facility that provides exams for survivors of sexual assault. The bill also would create civil immunity for city and state employees and contractors who are sued for implementing the law. Republicans cite invasion at southern border. House Representative Stephen Holt, Republican Denison, the bill's floor manager, employed arguments similar to those used by Texas officials to suggest the state has a right to enforce immigration laws. He said the influx of migrants in crossing the southern border should be considered an invasion under the Constitution. "This is a situation we face today," he said. "It is clear and present danger, and we do not have time to delay and hope the federal government suddenly decides to do its job. Clearly, that is not happening." Boden proposed a bill earlier this year that would allow his administration to more strictly enforce border security and allow officials to more quickly deport migrants. The bill failed to garner support among congressional Republicans. Holt argued that the influx of border crossings presents a higher likelihood that criminal actors are entering the country illegally. He pointed to the death of Laken Riley, a Georgia woman whose suspected killer was not in the country legally, and said lax enforcement is enabling human suffering. Some opponents of the bill argued that it will encourage racial profiling, as law enforcement has no clear way to determine someone's legal residency status. Holt said that a confirmation of citizenship would only be triggered if a person was arrested for a separate crime, which is already part of the legal process. "I don't think there's any aspect of racial profiling here, because they don't do that for a speeding ticket," he said. "They don't take people into custody for a speeding ticket, so it's going to have to be something that raises to the level of where the person would have to be taken into custody." Democratic lawmaker: bill threatens immigrant communities. Democratic Representative Sammy Sheets of Cedar Rapids spoke out against the bill on Tuesday, arguing it would create more legal questions and encroach on what should be a federal issue. "This bill, in attempting to solve only one problem, risks creating others," he said. "Fostering fear among immigrant communities, disrupting families, and potentially hindering cooperation with law enforcement. The ripple effects of this bill could touch every facet of our community life." Sheets said the fear created by the bill had the potential to damage immigrant communities in Iowa. Sheets' mother immigrated to the U.S. from Syria, and he said his partner is also an immigrant. "Their stories, like those millions of immigrants throughout our nation's history, are testaments to the enduring spirit of those seeking a place to call home, to contribute, to become a part of the American mosaic," he said.
Voters okay Andalusia Fire Station. This is by Grace Kennicott. Andalusia Fire Protection District will get a new fire station. A little over 50% of voters approved the 20-year bond for a $5.2 million referendum in the Tuesday primary. Fire Chief Justin Hicks said they were grateful residents approved the referendum so they could keep providing services. "We're really happy the community decided to help us with this," Hicks said. "The next steps will be to meet with the architect and construction teams within the next few weeks," Hicks said. The Dispatch, Argus, Quad City Times, previously reported that the station will be 5 bays, 9,000 square feet, and located along Andalusia Road near Midwest Bank. The new station costs a total of $6 million, and about $800,000 is saved. Hicks said they hope to break ground this August, and that it would be about a 9 to 10 month build, with the goal of it operating sometime in 2025. Voters also approved the other referendum to levy a tax of 0.4% of the equalized assessed value of property in order to provide ambulance service. In Illinois, EAV is one-third of the market value for residential properties.
Okay, from the opinion page, a step toward lower costs for Medicare. Site-neutral payments for chemotherapy could save billions under House bill. As if to prove that every rule has an exception, the usually dysfunctional Republican majority House of Representatives has at least one sensible piece of bipartisan legislation on its record. In December, it passed a health care measure called the Lower Costs, More Transparency Act on a 320-71 vote. Also contrary to Congress's occasional practice, the bill's name is not hype. It actually would end a long-standing but irrational disparity in Medicare reimbursements for certain treatments, depending on whether they are administered in doctor's offices or hospitals. The savings would be more than $3.7 billion over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and beneficiaries' copayments would go down, too, by $40 a visit. The next thing that needs to happen is for the Senate to follow suit. At issue is how Medicare pays for drugs delivered by Medicaid providers, such as chemotherapy for cancer or infusions used to treat autoimmune diseases. Under current law, Medicare pays 2 to 3 times as much for these treatments if they are given in a hospital rather than a doctor's office. The medicines and the means of administering them are the same, only the price is different. In theory, the difference reflects the higher costs in running full-service 24/7 hospital as opposed to a physician's office that keeps weekly hours. In practice, Medicare's rules have created an incentive for hospitals to buy up physicians' practices, at which the hospitals can then charge the higher rate and pocket the profits. In 2021, Medicare paid hospital rates for more than half of the chemotherapy service it funded, up from a little more than a third in 2012. Indeed, research has found that consolidation among providers brings higher prices for everyone, including private medical insurers, often large corporate employers, and their beneficiaries. Larger medical systems have greater bargaining power in the healthcare marketplace. This legislation would also save money for private insurers, which pay hospitals almost double the Medicare rate. The Lower Costs, More Transparency Act would basically end these discrepancies for all drugs that must be administered by a healthcare provider, as opposed to, say, taken orally at home. Instead, it aims to create site-neutral payments. Site-neutral payment policy for Medicare would not be a cut to hospital funding, as the American Hospital Association and other defendants of the status quo claim. It would only do away with a payment disparity that has unintentionally caused higher costs. The House bill would be a small but significant step toward lower, more transparent Medicare payments, just as the bill's title says. Before this Congress ends, the Senate should send it to President Joe Biden for his signature.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the local section, and our headline is Speeding Concerns City. City will ramp up communication to try to slow drivers, by Sarah Watson. Bettendorf City Council members say speeding in residential neighborhoods has become one of the top complaints from their constituents. As a result, residents may see a ramped-up communication campaign by the city on social media and more officers or signage in areas with high numbers of complaints, especially school zones, city staff said. Council members identified slowing down speeders as a top priority when council members set goals in October for the upcoming year. On Monday, council members heard from city staff on plans to address it. Police Chief Keith Kimball said the goal was not to write more speeding tickets, but to get residents to change their behavior, especially in areas with a lot of complaints. Kimball said they plan to ramp up posts on social media and alerts to residents reminding them of the 25-mile-per-hour speed limit on residential roadways. The city also has routinely received a $50,000 yearly grant from the Iowa Governor's Traffic Safety Grant Program, which pays for the reimbursement of officers working overtime for additional traffic enforcement. Kimball said the department received the grant again for the upcoming year. Also, city engineer Brent Morlock said the city would develop a traffic calming policy aimed to use street infrastructure to slow drivers. It would include criteria for what streets would qualify for additional study and what traffic calming measures should be put in neighborhood infrastructure, such as additional signage, new lane markings, or speed humps. Last year, the city of Davenport was crafting a scoring policy to determine what neighborhood streets would qualify for additional study and traffic calming measures after piloting speed humps on a couple of streets that saw a lot of cut-through traffic. Kimball said the total number of warnings, citations, and arrests for traffic matters by BPD in 2023 was about 7,300. That includes citations or arrests during traffic accidents, minor equipment infractions, registration violations, driver's license violations, careless driving, operating while impaired, eluding, window tint, and seat belt violations.
Endocrine Associates to join Genesis by Gretchen Teske. Endocrine Associates of the Quad Cities will become a part of Genesis Health System effective Monday, March 25th. The practice will join Genesis Health Group Endocrinology, where Genesis will welcome the Endocrine Associates team of Ramesh Kumar Raman, M.D., Ramarayo Pradeep, M.D., and Yayashri Gowda, M.D., along with Melissa Caldwell, APN, and Michael Wieland, PA-C. They will join the Genesis Health Group Endocrinology team of Richard Nelson, D.O., and Salem Gahala, M.D. Together we will be stronger as we work to increase the region's access to endocrinology services, in addition to providing the best patient experience and care coordination through the nationally recognized Genesis and Mercy One system of care, said Bo Dexter, Eastern Iowa Vice President, Operations Medical Group, Mercy One. The primary Endocrine Associates Association's location in Moline will remain at 612 35th Avenue, Moline, under the name Genesis Health Group, Endocrinology, Moline. Endocrine Associates' satellite location at 1989 Spruce Hills Drive in Bettendorf will close. This office will move to Genesis Health Group, Endocrinology, 2535 Maple Crest Road, Suite 10 in Bettendorf.
Clinton stabbing, woman facing assault charge by Thomas Geyer. A Clinton woman is accused of stabbing one of her roommates in the neck during an argument Monday, Clinton police said. Tara Seitz, 28, is charged in Clinton County Circuit Court with one count of assault causing serious injury. The charge is a Class D felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 5 years. According to the arrest affidavit filed by Clinton police officer J.C. Schumacher, at 9:36 a.m. Monday, Schumacher was dispatched to a residence in the 100 block of Fayette Street. Schumacher stated in her affidavit that she arrived on the scene to find a man bleeding profusely from the neck. The man stated he had been in a verbal altercation with one of his roommates, Tara Seitz. The man said Seitz pulled a knife from her pocket and threatened to stab him. Seitz went at the man, and the man hit Seitz to get away. Seitz then stabbed the man in the neck. Another roommate witnessed the attack. Seitz fled the scene before police arrived. She was found later at another location and taken into custody. During a post-Miranda interview with police, Seitz admitted to stabbing the victim in the neck, according to the affidavit. During a first appearance on the charge Tuesday in Clinton County District Court, Associate Judge Kimberly Shepherd scheduled a preliminary hearing in the case for March 28th. Seats are being held Wednesday night in the Clinton County Jail on a cash-only bond of $5,000. Seats has been charged 5 times with domestic abuse assault since 2019. Of those counts, 2 were dismissed and 2 were reduced to simple misdemeanor assault. She pleaded guilty to one of those counts in May of 2022 and was sentenced to serve 1 year on unsupervised probation.
Okay, the Silvis is getting its first brewery. Punk Rock Pizza will open in May by Gretchen Teske. Beer and pizza are on their way to Silvis, and they're going to be in the same building. Punk Rock Pizza and Brewery will open in May at 637 First Street in Silvis. The building was formerly home to Slugger's Pizza and St. Giuseppe's. The new brewery is owned by the Curless family, with Doug Curless taking the helm on the project. Opening a restaurant and brewery is a new endeavor for him, and he said, but something he's always wanted to do. At home, he makes wood-fired pizza and wants to bring that to his community. Curless shopped around for locations near the bike paths in East Moline and Moline before landing on the current spot. Initially, we were just going to do pizza and have craft beer, but things snowballed and one thing evolved into the next, he said. The brew system was delivered on Wednesday, and the Woodstone pizza oven was picked up last month. Licensing is still being worked out, he said, but assuming all goes to plan, he hopes to open the doors in May. Updates on the brewery and an official open date can be found on the business page on Facebook. Other than that, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, he said with a laugh. But he must have somewhat of an idea. A full remodel on the inside is wrapping up with Curless's team uncovering an original wood slat ceiling they have restained. Massive metal beams, you would have swore, came off the I-74 bridge, run across the interior, and accent the punk rock theme of the place. Gambling machines will be in the back room, and a curved bar will offer different views for diners. One section will directly face the pizza ovens and be reserved for those looking to dine in. The other curve will be in front of the taps for those looking to enjoy the home-brewed beers. The name for the brewery stems from Curless's love of punk rock music, with Blink 182 and Less Than Pike Jake topping his list of favorites, but the concept was a little more detailed. He noticed a trend this year as he trained for triathlon. The more and more you ride bikes, you're in a different culture, he said. People like to ride bikes and drink craft beer and eat good food. The brewery is not directly on the bike path, but close enough where people can reasonably get to it, he said. On the menu will be the obvious choices of pizza, but it won't be what most Quad City citizens are used to eating. The pizza is going to be the rebel against Quad City style pizza, he said. I love Quad City style pizza. I just think there's enough of it. Curless said the choice went back to the business's name, with punk rock music representing going off the beaten path and forging its own way. The pizza at Punk Rock will be artisan style with a thin crust and a cross between Italian and New York styles, he said. Down the line, the family has discussed adding on appetizers, pastas, and other dishes. But for now, the focus is on the dine-in pizza experience. Punk Rock Pizza will be open 7 days a week to start, with hours to be determined in the near future. We're going to be a beer place that you can come and hang out and hopefully get some good pizza, he said.
And one final article here. Women's murder charge to drop by Anthony Watt. Authorities have dropped a murder case against a Rock Island woman. A gunman shot DeSavian Foster, 19, Rock Island, to death on May 22, 2022, in the area of 10th Avenue and 15th Street, Rock Island, according to previous reporting. The Rock Island County State's Attorney's Office has charged two people with first-degree murder in relation to Foster's killing, according to county court records. They are Damia Payton, 22, and Terancy C. Kitchen, 20, both of Rock Island. Payton also faced charges of aggravated discharge of a firearm, court records state. In February, prosecutors dropped the murder and discharge of a firearm charges against Payton, and she pleaded guilty to obstructing justice as part of an agreement with the state attorney's office. Prosecutors charged Kitchen not long after the shooting, records state. they charged Peyton in August of 2023. During Kitchen's preliminary hearing in 2022, Rock Island Police Detective Jonathan Shepard testified that Foster and another man were walking along 10th Avenue at 15th Street to go get a tire when a ski-masked gunman approached on foot and began shooting. Foster was hit and suffered fatal injuries, Shepard testified. The other man fled and was not hurt in the attack. After the shooting, the masked gunman ran away, Shepard said. A family member of Kitchen, who was nearby, heard the shots and then saw a person in all black and wearing a ski mask, but recognized the person as Kitchen, Shepard said. The murder case filed against Peyton does not provide details on exactly how investigators think she was involved in the death of Foster, but Illinois law, under certain circumstances, allows someone to be prosecuted for a crime even if that person did not directly commit the act. These circumstances can include intentionally facilitating the act in some way, according to Illinois statute. Another example is a person being involved in a criminal scheme with others. All involved in the plot are responsible for acts performed to accomplish that plot. The state attorney's office has already filed an obstruction of justice case against Peyton in 2022, also related to the Foster killing. Peyton was in a relationship with Kitchen in May of 2022, court records state. Authorities allege Peyton provided false information in an attempt to obstruct their prosecution of Kitchen. At the same hearing in which she entered her plea, Judge Frank Furr sentenced her to 24 months of probation and 30 hours public service, according to court records. Peyton testified as a prosecution witness in Kitchen's January murder trial, court records state. The details of her testimony were not available in the current court record. On January 26th, a jury convicted Kitchen on the murder charge, according to court records. His trial lasted 5 days. Kitchen's sentencing has been set for March 25th. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, there are no obituaries, but I think we could read the pending obituaries today, so I'll turn that over to Dorothy.
All right, the pending obituaries. Stephen M. Grutzmacher, 58, of Davenport, died Sunday, March 17, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory, Moline. Terry Arthur Klein, 67, of Davenport, passed away on March 18 at Genesis Medical Center, East Davenport. Arrangements were entrusted to Wendt Funeral Home in Moline. Nancy L. Moore, 68, of Maquoketa, passed away on Tuesday morning, March 19, at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Loretta I. Pryor, 99, of Davenport, died Tuesday, March 19, at her home. Arrangements are pending at Halligan's McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. Raymond C. Rose, 85, of East Moline, passed away Monday, March 18, at his home. Arrangements are pending at Schroeder Mortuary in Silvis. LaDonna Shanahan, 75, of Bettendorf and formerly of Maquoketa, passed away on Monday, March 18, at Bickford College in Davenport. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. Now, there are no really obituaries for local people. There are three obituaries of renowned people. I'll just read a little bit about each. M. Emmett Walsh, unforgettable character actor, dies. M. Emmett Walsh shows a picture of him arriving at 214 Film Independent Spirit Awards, March 1st, 2014, in Santa Monica, California. Walsh, the character actor who brought his unmistakable face and unsettling presence to films including Blood Simple and Blade Runner, died Tuesday, March 19, at age 88, his manager said Wednesday. A renowned concert pianist dies at 95. And we are talking here about Byron Janis. This undated photo provided by Maria Cooper Janis shows Byron Janis, the renowned concert pianist and composer. Janis, who broke barriers as a Cold War culture ambassador and later overcame severe arthritis that nearly robbed him of his playing abilities, has died at age 95. Janice passed away Thursday evening, March 14, at a hospital in New York City, according to his wife, Maria Cooper Janice. And then Cockney, who is a rebel singer, dies at 73. And it shows a picture of several people together. Steve Harley, center and Cockney rebel at London's Heathrow Airport, February 26, 1975, on their arrival from America. British musician Harley, whose band Cockney Rebel had a huge hit with the song Make Me Smile, Come Up and See Me, has died. He was 73. Harley's family said Sunday, March 17th, he passed away peacefully at home with his family by his side.
Okay, and we're going to go to the opinion section for a couple more articles. Biden must inspire turnout in this key Michigan county. This is out of Saginaw, Michigan. This is by L.Z. Granderson. Five states went from red to blue in 2020. My home state, Michigan, is one of them. Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania are the others. Within that Fab Five, just eight counties that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 flipped for President Joe Biden in 2020. One such county is Saginaw, a metro area in Michigan of about 200,000. So if you're wondering why Biden would make two campaign stops here in the rain last week, that's part of the answer. In the past 40 years, only two Republicans have managed to win Saginaw in the general election, Ronald Reagan and Trump. Reagan flipping it was not a surprise. His opponent, Walter Mondale, managed to win only his own state in 1984, Minnesota. But Trump's victory in 2016 was so shocking to Democrats that in her memoir, What Happened, Hillary Clinton wrote, "And I suppose it is possible that a few more trips to Saginaw or a few more ads on the air in Waukesha, Wisconsin, would have tipped a couple thousand votes here and there." Trump beat Clinton here by 1,073 votes. Biden flipped it back blue by only 303. In the big picture, Saginaw made up less than 2% of the statewide turnout in 2020. If it shrinks further, Biden could be in real trouble. And that's a concern in light of the more than 100,000 voters who marked uncommitted in the state's Democratic primary in protest of the Biden administration's handling of the war in Gaza. Saginaw is the only county in Michigan that voted twice for Obama-Biden, that Biden-Harris was able to take away from Trump. All the other counties stayed red. So, to secure a win in Michigan come November, he'll need to take Clinton's advice and make a few more trips to Saginaw. His first stop was at the home of Saginaw School Board member Kevin Rooker and Bill Ostisch, who in 2018 became the city's first out gay councilman. The second was at Pleasant View Golf Course for a conversation Biden had with Hurley Coleman III and his 13-year-old son, Hurley Coleman IV. The family comes from a long line of preachers. A politician rolling through a black church come campaign season is a familiar scene. But Biden and the Colemans sitting in the clubhouse was not the usual fare. The campaign is incorporating more of these kitchen table conversations to give Biden a chance to listen more than speak. The reported erosion of black support has both dominated headlines and been reflected in the primaries. In his conversation with the family, Biden mentioned his long history of fighting racial injustice. Afterward, I asked the president what was it like hearing media reports about black support fading. He said it was kind of fascinating, given his record, adding that the black community, he said, is the reason I got elected the first time in 1972 as a senator. I got over 85% of the African-American vote. As that old expression goes, the president continued, the black community brought me to the dance, and so it's always been where my interest, my heart, has been. And if you notice, I have more African-Americans in my cabinet than anybody ever has. I've appointed more black circuit court judges than every other president in American history. I appointed the first black woman to the Supreme Court, the first black woman as vice president. Some black voters are disappointed with Congress not passing comprehensive criminal justice reform or voting rights protections, or who don't feel like they're sharing in the gains of the soaring stock market under this administration. Biden's hope is that these intimate conversations will help him make his case to potentially disaffected voters, a strong enough cause to inspire turnout. As a young African-American male whose working-class faith from my life has been a major component, the elder Coleman said after his talk with Biden, I've seen it operate in my grandparents' life, in my father's life, and now we're putting it in my son's life. So to know that our leader of the free world, our president, believes in faith and his core belief is embedded with faith, the decisions that he makes, the responsibility of delegating and leading this entire country, he's leaning and depending on God and his faith to make the decisions that's needed. And I think that if our president has a core belief in faith, then that faith is going to take this country where it needs to go. And that again was by L.Z. Granderson, who writes for the Los Angeles Times.
Our next story is the stories that Oppenheimer movie didn't tell. The film Oppenheimer swept the box office last summer and helped reignite public discourse about nuclear weapons and the ever-present threat of their use. It's perhaps inevitable that the movie, which dramatizes the United States' development of the atomic bomb, still provides only a partial understanding of the complex reality of physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer's life and legacy. With the movie dominating the awards season, the audience deserves to know about two crucial stories that the movie left out. A central storyline of the film is Oppenheimer's loss of his security clearance and eventual excommunication from the halls of power as a result of the Red Scare and his advocacy of nuclear disarmament policies that people in power did not want to hear. In the movie, that storyline ends with a flash forward to Oppenheimer receiving a presidential award in old age. But even at that time, Oppenheimer was still officially regarded as having been blameworthy. The decision by the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, that cost him his security clearance was still on the books. To some, this was merely an unfortunate historical footnote, one of many wrongs committed during that era. But for a persistent few of us, led by U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, the attacks on Oppenheimer's character to silence him mattered. We saw that the decision loomed as a warning to scientists that their participation in the political process was conditional on not rocking the boat too hard. So we joined with others and urged administration to overturn the AEC's decision. Finally, in December 2022, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm and the Department of Energy vacated the decision against Oppenheimer, writing a historical wrong. The harrowing story of another group of nuclear victims was completely left out. They are still awaiting justice today. Oppenheimer makes a centerpiece of the Trinity test, the world's first nuclear explosion. But the viewer could be forgiven for thinking that the scientists in the film were its only witnesses. Just off-screen were many other witnesses. Communities surrounding the Trinity testing site were rural, low-income, and largely Hispanic and indigenous. Like the scientists, some saw a flash and heard the explosion. Others saw the mushroom cloud, and many remembered black rain in the following days as radioactive dust and debris that had been carried into the atmosphere by the explosion fell back down. Under the cloud of wartime secrecy, it would be years before anyone knew they had unwittingly received the first doses of weapons-grade atomic radiation. In the years to come, that distinction would manifest in abnormally high rates of cancer, birth defects, and other medical conditions. This community would be called downwinders, for living downwind of Trinity. Their search for justice is also a story of persistence. It was not until 1990 that these groups were recognized by the federal government and given limited compensation for what they suffered without their knowledge or consent. The need to right this historical wrong carries its own importance today. It would be a powerful reminder that the government should not harm its own citizens under the banner of national security, or should its mistakes in secrecy. An important compensation would make an immediate difference. Downwinders and their families are still suffering from the health effects of nuclear testing, and this assistance would be a lifeline. Congress must act urgently now to expand and extend the program before it expires this July. Oppenheimer is the latest welcome step in recounting that history. Wrongs must still be righted and lessons learned. And this here is that Bronson is president and CEO of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Reeser handled the flight over J. Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance as a senior aide to U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy. They wrote this for the Chicago Tribune.
Okay, now we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'll start with what is on the air today. College baseball. At 6 o'clock this evening on ACCN, we have Louisville at Wake Forest. Also at 6 o'clock on SECN, we have Arkansas at Auburn. At 6:30, Mississippi State is at Texas A&M, and you can catch that on ESPNU. We have college basketball NCAA tournament men's. We have already in progress Michigan State versus Mississippi State on CBS at 11:40. Also, probably in progress, we have Duquesne versus BYU on True TV. At 12:30, Akron versus Creighton on TNT. At 1 o'clock, Long Beach State versus Arizona on TBS. At 1:45, Wagner versus North Carolina on CBS. At 2:10, Morehead State versus Illinois on True TV. At 3:30, Oregon versus South Carolina on TNT. Also at 3:30, Nevada versus Dayton on TBS. At 5:50, Colorado State versus Texas on TNT. At 6:10, Oakland at Kentucky on CBS. At 6:25, McNeese State versus Gonzaga. And it does not give me a channel for that one. I'm sorry. At 6:35, South Dakota State versus Iowa State. You can catch that on True TV. At 8:20, St. Peter's versus Tennessee on TNT. At 8:40, North Carolina State versus Texas Tech on CBS. At 8:55, Samford versus Kansas on TBS. And at 9:05, Drake will be playing Washington State. You can catch that one on True TV. As for the college women's basketball NCAA tournament, at 6 o'clock, first four, Arizona versus Auburn on ESPN2, and then at 8 o'clock, UT Martin versus Holy Cross, also on ESPN2. College wrestling, the NCAA tournament started at 11 a.m. this morning. You can catch that on ESPNU. And at 6 o'clock tonight, it also continues on ESPN. For figure skating, at 2 o'clock, you can see the World Championships of the Men's Short on USA Channel. And also on USA at 7 o'clock, you can see the Pairs Free Skate World Championships. In golf today at 1 o'clock, the PGA Tour Vassbar Championship on the Golf Channel. And at 5 o'clock, the LPGA Tour from Palos Verdes, California, also on the Golf Channel. Major League Baseball. Ooh, that was at 5 a.m. I think we missed that one. It says 5 a.m. anyway. Let's go to the NBA tonight at 6 o'clock on NBA TV. New Orleans will be at Orlando. At 7 o'clock on NBC SCH channel, we've got Houston at Chicago. At 9:30, Atlanta at Phoenix on NBA TV. In the NHL tonight at 9 o'clock, Chicago is at Anaheim, and you can see that on the NBC SCH Plus channel. 9:30, Seattle at Las Vegas on ESPN. And there are a couple of spring training games at noon, New York Yankees versus Atlanta on the Major League Baseball Network. And at 3 o'clock, Chicago White Sox versus Kansas City, also on the Major League Baseball Network. If you want to see soccer at noon today, the Euro qualifier, Georgia versus Luxembourg, is on FS2. And at 2:30, Wales versus Finland. So that's it for what's on the air today. And now we'll go to our front page. And there's an article, Young Steam Wheelers, excited for new season. QC has only 6 returning players. This is by Tom Johnston. When the Quad City Steam Wheelers take the field for Friday's Indoor Football League opener, they will be doing so with a very young, inexperienced team. But don't think for one second that has lowered expectations for the local squad. We've got a lot of new faces, but a lot of people who really want to get after it, said first-year linebacker Sean Conahan. You're going to see a lot of grit, a lot of hustle, and a lot of discipline. Coach Corey Ross has brought a new dynamic to the roster for QC's 5th official IFL season, the franchise's 6th season, including the dormant COVID-19 seasons. It's going to be exciting, said Ross, extending the syllables on the adjective when talking about the 2024 club. The Steam Wheelers have only 6 returning players from last year's playoff squad still on the roster of 29 as it stood Wednesday. The roster, which includes no fewer than 18 rookies, has to be trimmed to 25 by Thursday. The decisions we've had to make have been tough on the coaches, said Ross of the roster cutdowns ahead of Friday's opener at Vibrant Arena at the Mark against the Sioux Falls Storm. That's a good thing. We're excited for Friday and excited to see how guys react. There are some guys that are very, very, very surprising and I think will surprise the fans. Ross admitted during a Wednesday media session on the Vibrant Arena turf that these have been the toughest roster cuts he's had to make. And the decisions don't get much easier to determine who will join new kicker Kyle Kaplan on the 21-player active roster. In fact, Ross said there is a very high probability that the active roster will be rotating throughout the season. Everybody who makes this roster is going to play this year, said the veteran coach. There's not a guy playing the entire season. There's not one guy playing the entire season. There's going to be guys playing because that's how much talent we have and how smart these guys are. It's a testament to those guys and a great thing for us to have as a coaching staff. Ross was still trying to figure out his quarterback situation. After cutting Asher O'Hara, Judd Erickson and Mike Irwin are still battling for the starting spot. Returning on offense for QC are receivers Kevin Rudd and Jared Harrington, and lineman Joe Krall. Defensive returners include lineman Jalen Swan and DBs Malik Duncan and Darian Jackson. Once things click and it feels where things need to be, you're going to see special units across the board, said Ross. We've got some great DBs, a receiving core right now that has probably been one of the best receiving cores I've had in Quad City. That's going to be one of the toughest decisions on starters because of that. And those in the QC camp feel the pieces are in place for nothing short of a third straight playoff run. The number one thing that we have on all our minds is championships, said first-year Wheeler Malik Owens, who was an all-rookie defender in Tucson last year. It all starts off with day one and game one. This week, Friday, we plan on going out there and showing how dominant of a defense we are. And Modern Woodman Ballpark voted top venue. Modern Woodman Ballpark has been named the best minor league ballpark in America by USA Today, 10 best for the second time in 11 years. The home of the Quad Cities River Bandits claimed the top spot among 20 ballparks up for consideration and was one of only 4 facilities that host single A or high A level teams. All of us with the River Bandits are appreciative and humbled to go 2 for 2 in being named the best minor league ballpark in America by US Today 10 Best, said River Bandits owner Dave Heller. There are so many great ballparks across the country, and for Quad Cities, one of the smaller markets in minor league baseball, to beat out great ballparks in heavy populated NFL cities such as Las Vegas, Nashville, Charlotte, and Buffalo is really a testament both to our awesome fans and to Kansas City Royals fans throughout the country, as well as our wonderful partnership with the city of Davenport. The 2024 season marks the River Bandits' 4th year as a high A affiliate of the Kansas City Royals and 63rd as members of the Midwest League. Our season starts April 5th against the South Bend Cubs, and I can't wait to personally welcome everyone back to the best ballpark in America, Heller said. Built in 1931, Modern Woodman Park is the 4th oldest ballpark in minor league baseball and has been home to 10 affiliated Davenport-based clubs and hundreds of future major league players since the Quad Cities franchise was purchased by Main Street Baseball in 2007 MWP has undergone several major renovations and numerous additions. Previously, Modern Woodmead Park was named one of the nation's best by the likes of Bleacher Report, Ballpark Digest, and Parade Magazine. And finally, women's college basketball, Iowa's Clark headlines All-American First Team by Doug Feinberg. I'm just going to read part of this article. Caitlin Clark has been a mainstay on the Associated Press All-American team the past few seasons. The NCAA's all-time scoring leader from Iowa was honored for the third straight year Wednesday, becoming the 11th player to earn the distinction three times. She was a unanimous choice from the 35-member national media panel that chooses the AP Top 25 each week. She was joined on the team by Stanford's Cameron Brink, UConn's Paige Buchers, and freshman Juju Watkins of USC, and Hannah Hidalgo of Notre Dame. They are only the fourth and fifth freshmen to make the AP team since it began in 1994-95, joining Oklahoma's Courtney Paris, UConn's Maya Moore, and Buchers. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.